Thanks for the invitation. It's been many years since I visited Perimeter, so I'm happy to be here again. So this is a project which I've been working on for a couple of years. It started when I hired a summer student who was named Peter Banks. And his project was to write some computer code for calculations with Poisson brackets and deformation quantization. But we quickly were out of our depths, and we had to enlist the help of one of the local experts on Feynman integrals. That's Eric Panzer. So the work that I'm going to talk about today is what's come out of that. So the goal was simply to compute a certain formula on a computer, but it ended up having some interesting mathematics underlying. Okay, so maybe I should just keep it the archive number. Okay, so in this audience, I probably don't have to give a lot of background on quantization, but let me just set some notation. So a deformation quantization of some x, which is either going to be a C-infinity manifold, or maybe a complex affine smooth variety. It's the data of a non-commutative deformation of the product of functions. So it's a deformation of the algebra of functions as an associative algebra. So it will be some new product of functions, which looks like the original one, plus some higher order corrections. You want to think of this as taking a phase space and producing its quantum mechanical analog. And at first order, you can measure the amount of non-commutativity of this algebra that's given by this commutator, which is going to be something times h bar plus higher order terms. And this fg is a Poisson bracket. So for a long time, it was an open question in mathematical physics whether if you're given a manifold equipped with a Poisson bracket, whether you could produce a quantum mechanical analog to find this non-commutative algebra. This was solved by Kontsevich in the 1990s. What he proved is that every Poisson manifold has a deformation like this. So it has a quantization. And actually, this gives a complete bijection between Poisson brackets on X considered up to some diffeomorphism and non-commutative deformations of this algebra OX considered up to some appropriate notion of isomorphism. And it's a bit better than that. He gives actually an explicit formula in the case of affine space. When the case of an affine space, X is equal to some AD with coordinates x1 up to xd, the formula is a Feynman expansion. So I need to tell you, given two functions, f and g, how to take their product. It's a sum, h bar to the n over n factorial, n greater than or equal to 0. And then at every order in h bar, there's some collection of graphs. And each graph contributes coefficients. Let me call it, say, C sub gamma, and some expression B gamma, which involves the matrix formed by the Poisson brackets of the coordinates, and then the two functions f and g that you're trying to take the product of. So I need to explain a little bit what are these c gammas and b gammas. Well, b gamma is a differential operator, some kind of differential operator which is linear in f and g but nonlinear in the Poisson bracket, has order n, and it's defined in some kind of combinatorial fashion using the graph. And the thing that I'm going to focus mostly on today are these coefficients c gamma. Well, in Kontsevich's original formula, they're given by real numbers, although there are variants of the procedure which give you complex numbers. And this c gamma is given by some Feynman integral, so it's an integral over a manifold, which I'll call Cn2, of a differential form. And the Cnm is the moduli space of n, m marked disks. So I think of a disk which has some z1, z2, up to zn points in the interior. And then on the boundary, there's a special point called infinity. And then there are a bunch of other ones along the boundary. I don't know, maybe x1. No, that's bad. Y1, y2, so on up to ym. So I have a complex analytic disk with some marked points on the boundary and in the interior. And I consider it up to phi holomorphism. OK, so for instance, what is Cn, 2? Well, if I have a disk which has three boundary mark points, one called infinity and two other ones, then I can send y1 to the point 0 and y2 to the number 1. And then I identify any disk with the upper half plane. And then the remaining data of the problem are just the location of the interior marked points. And so those go to sent to some points zj in the interior of the disk. And so what I get is tuples z1 up to zn in the upper half plane n times, such that zi is not equal to zj whenever I is not equal to j. So the marked points are never allowed to collide. OK. Yeah, and then this omega gamma is a volume form. Which lies in a certain subalgebra of the differential forms, which I'll call A. And this is the algebra which is generated by logarithmic derivatives of cross ratios of marked points and their complex conjugates. So I'll give an example. So for instance, if I take this Cn, 2, let's even take n is equal to 1, then this is a copy of the upper half plane. And the only interesting information is the location of this single marked point z. OK, but z, you see, is the cross ratio of z, 0, 1, and infinity. Probably in this order. OK. So one of the things in this algebra, one of the generators, is the differential form d log z, which is dz over z. OK, Well, now I can start applying conformal transformations, which would, for instance, take dz over z to dz over z minus 1. And I also want to allow the complex conjugates of anything that's appearing. So then I get dz bar over z bar and dz bar over z bar minus 1. And then there's only other one thing to consider, which is the possibility that I have 0, 1, I have z and its reflection, z bar. I could take some cross ratio which involves z and z bar. So then I would get something which involved dz minus z bar over z minus z bar. So you see, these forms have singularities at points, either z is equal to 0, z equals 1. This one has a singularity along the real line. OK, but anyway, this is the algebra which is necessary. Is there any questions so far? So I wasn't planning to give the exact recipe, the exact Feynman rules, which produce the integrand and this combinatorial differential operator. But let me just give a couple examples of the output of this formula. Happy to give more details offline. So let's look at the simplest case, where x is a two-dimensional space with coordinates x1 and x2. And let's consider the standard Poisson brackets in Darboux coordinates. Bracket of x1 and x2 is equal to 1. So as I said, this formula, it involves derivatives of f and g and some derivatives of this matrix of Poisson brackets. But the constant matrix 1 doesn't have very many derivatives. So actually, most of these terms die. And you can explicitly calculate. There's really only one integral which you have to calculate to calculate this formula. And what you find is the following formula, which is goes back to the early days of quantum mechanics due to Moyle. Make sure I get the constants right. So f star g is the sum h bar to the n over 2 to the n n factorial. And then at each order in h bar, there's the following contribution, minus 1 to the power I, n choose I, nth derivative of f distributed between x1 and x2, and then the nth derivative of g distributed in the opposite way, and minus I x1 and I x2s. OK, and so the one nice thing about this formula, for example, is that if f and g are polynomials, then at some point you get past the degree of these polynomials, and all of these higher derivatives will die. So if f and g are polynomials, then this series truncates. So it's actually a convergent series. Now, for instance, if I take x1 star x2, then I get the ordinary product. And the only contribution left is the h bar term, which is h bar over 2. And x2 star x1 is x1 x2 minus h bar over 2. And we get the canonical commutation relations. x1 star x2 minus x2 star x1 is equal to h bar. Yeah, so in this way, you can sort of compute the quantization in the following sense. If you take the polynomial ring equipped with this new product, what you get is generated by x1 and x2 modulo this relation, x1 star x2 minus x2 star x1 is equal to h bar. This is the Biot algebra. So even though the formula itself is very complicated, if you want to compute the product of two individual functions, you still know what the algebra is. okay? And then there's one more case where things work out nicely like this. And so now we take X to be affine space of any dimension. And let's assume that the brackets xi, xj, rather being constant, are linear functions. So some linear combination, cijk, xk. And cijk is, maybe I should say lambda, unrelated to those c's. So the lambdas are constants. Well, the Jacobi identity for the Poisson brackets tells you that this defined the structure constant of a Lie algebra. So this is the same thing as saying that G, which is the span of the Xi's, is a Lie algebra. And now you go and you make this calculation again. Once again, all of the derivatives of the brackets beyond some order vanish. Series truncates to a polynomial for polynomials f and g. And so you have a nice, honest algebra, which is has a parameter h bar. And what do you get? You exactly get the noncommutative algebra, which is the universal enveloping algebra of this Lie algebra. So this is generated by the xi's subject to the relation xi, xj minus xj, xi is the Lie bracket times h bar. Any questions so far? Okay. So now you ask the question, and I keep going this way, what happens if I consider more complicated Poisson bracket, maybe one which has quadratic polynomials? So let's look at this bracket, U1 brackets U2 is equal to U1 times U2, the so-called log canonical bracket. So these are coordinates on A2. And let's try to calculate the star product, U star V, U1 star U2. Well, now it turns out that, unfortunately, the series no longer truncates. So even if you stick in the linear functions U1 and U2, you get an infinite formal power series. But you can at least say that it's some power series in H bar times U1, U2. And similarly, U2 star U1 comes out to G of minus H bar U1, U2, G H bar is some formal power series. Now, we don't know if this series converges. We don't know what its sum is. But because I have a computer program, I can tell you the first few terms. So here's, so this is a computer computation. It starts off like this. Well, it's always going to have to start off as 1, because that's deforming the ordinary product. Next step, we have an h bar over 2. So that things match the Poisson bracket. Then we have h bar squared over 24. And then we have minus h bar cubed over 48. And minus h bar to the 4 over 1440. Plus h bar to the 5 over 480. And then minus 17 over 184,320. Plus 251 zeta of 3 squared over pi to the power of 6 at h bar to the 6. OK, so this is indeed the Riemann zeta function. And the thing that you should be interested in, if not worried, is the fact that zeta 3 squared over pi to the 6 is conjecturally an irrational number. So this is zeta 3.
So is it like h 6 is where you first start hitting loops or something?
Yeah, part of the goal of my talk. No, I don't think it's about loops. Actually, for different choices of the propagator and deformation quantization, you'll see these numbers appearing earlier. But I'm going to explain why it appears only at H to the 6. Anyway, so zeta 3 is indeed the sum 1 over k cubed, where k is at least 1. OK. Well, that's a little bit worrisome, because probably several people in the audience are familiar with these Poisson brackets and know the correct way to quantize them is by the relation u1 star u2 is equal to some function times u2 u1. And that function q of h bar is supposed to be e to the h, morally. And actually, miraculously, that is the case. So if you compute gh over g minus h, at least as far as I can check it on my computer, this relation holds. Of course, the easier way to arrange that would have been to take gh to be like e to the h bar over 2 or something simple like that. Lots of other ways you could arrange this relation. It's not the one that Kontsevich spits out.
So you commented on the uniqueness of the computation, right? So in that was module of some duration, and does that bring up the coefficient here?
So the way that I would think about it is Kontsevich gives a specific formula, which is a bijection between those two moduli spaces, if you like. And so that coefficient zeta 3 is one of the coefficients that appear in the Taylor expansion of his map. So in that sense, it's there, you know, no matter which Poisson brackets you stick in. Yeah. However, there is a uniqueness issue in the sense that Kontsevich's formula is not the only universal formula you can write down. You change the universal formula, you can even arrange for all these coefficients to definitely be rational. However, we don't know at present whether you will get the same algebras up to isomorphism. So you'll get different formula for the product, but it's conceivable still that they're the same algebra in disguise. It's a very interesting question.
So somewhere in here I could like change h to h plus h cubed and just stick that in everywhere. Is that already part of your equivalence relation? Or worse, I could change h to h plus zeta 6 h, whatever.
Yeah, so two points, I guess. The one way to think about that is that you're changing the universal quantization formula. But if you just do it in that naive way, it may not have all the universal properties that you're looking for. The other comment is that although people often talk about the deformations as power series in h-bar like I'm doing here, if you look carefully at what he proved in that paper, he showed really that those two moduli spaces have an isomorphism. And so if you take an h-bar family in one, you get an h-bar family in the other. And that's really what this map is doing. So if you pick a different h-bar family over here, you get a different h-bar family over here. OK, so I guess the point of my talk is to explain somewhat why this number appeared and why it was the first one to appear. So shortly after Kontsevich wrote this paper, there was parallel work by Tamarkin, where he found a different way of proving the existence of these universal quantizations. And it involved some nice ideas from the theory of operads and Drinfeld associators and these sorts of things. And Kontsevich wrote a response to that paper called Operads and Motives in Deformation Quantization, in which he foresaw many structural things about deformation quantization, which at the time were somewhat conjectural. So in particular, if you look at the conjectures in that paper, then one of the key outputs is that the coefficients in his formula should be expressible in terms of certain numbers called multiple zeta values. So let me let me give the definition of multiple zeta values. So I'm going to work here with a kind of normalized variance. So a normalized multiple zeta value henceforth abbreviated to MZV of weight n is a number of the following form: zeta tilde of n1 up to nd is a sum. It looks very similar to the Riemann zeta function, but it has more arguments. So I'm going to put a normalization factor of 2 pi I to the power n out front. And then I have a sum over indices k1 less than k2 less than kd. And it's a sum 1 over k1 to the n1 up to kd to the n. So it's just some particular infinite sum, which is a generalization of the Riemann zeta function. And so this part gives you a real number. And if you want it to converge, actually, you'll need nd to be at least 2. So this part gives you a real number, and this part gives you an imaginary number or a real number, depending on the parity of n. So this is a real number if n is even, and it's an imaginary number if n is odd. OK. And let's kind of take the collection of all these numbers. Let me call that z tilde, and this will be the z linear span of all these numbers zeta tilde. And also, I want to throw in the number 1 half for reasons which I'll hopefully explain later. So this now gives me some z submodule of the complex numbers. And one fact, which is not at all obvious, is that there's a formula showing you that if I multiply two numbers together, say one of weight n, so first of all, I should say inside of here, there's the span of the numbers of weight less than or equal to big N, where I give this guy weight, weight one. D. D is unrelated to N. So yeah, I should say.
N only appears.
So there are D entries here. Mm-hmm. And this D is given a name. It's called the depth. So there's a weight and a depth.
The weight is only the power.
The weight, sorry. N1 plus so on plus ND has to add up to big N. Thanks. That's important. So the depth is unrelated to big N, aside from the fact that, you know, if N is a small number, then you can only add up so many positive integers to get up to N. But otherwise, they're unrelated.
The little n has to be ordered in any way?
The little n's don't have to be ordered in any way, provided that this one is at least 2. Yeah. Any numbers can go there. OK, so I have this collection of numbers, the numbers of weight n. They span some submodule in here. And there's an amazing formula called the shuffle product, which says that if you multiply number of weight n with a number of weight m, then what you get is a number of weights n plus m. So you can imagine how such a fact might be proven. You have two infinite sums. You multiply them together. You expand out and write it as a linear combination of individual sums instead of some kind of combinatorics of simplices involved because you've got some simplex here that you're summing over. But such manipulations can be done. There's also a geometric explanation for this, which I find a little bit easier to digest. Maybe I'll say something about that later. Anyway, there's a shuffle product, which tells you that actually this Z submodule, which a priori had no extra algebraic structure, is actually a subring of the complex numbers. And the ring structure is compatible with the filtration. So in particular, this tells you that there exist many, many different algebraic relations between these multiple zeta values. I can multiply two together and get a linear combination of them. So it's perhaps a little bit surprising that there exists a conjectural basis for the Q vector space you get by extending scalars. The dimension, oh, and I also want to add, at any weight, there's a conjectural basis. So the dimension of this was conjectured by Zagier. Hoffman gave a conjectural basis. And it's known to span from work of Goncharov and Tarasoma. So what does that mean in practice? It means that if you want to, say, do a computer calculation involving these numbers, there's some nice basis in which you can try to make your calculations. So let me just tell you what this thing looks like for small weight. So here's the weight, big N. And let me give you some real generators and some imaginary generators. So in weight 0, everything is an integer. So that's an integral multiple of 1. In weight 1, the only thing that you can get is a multiple of 1/2. Because of the fact that this nd had to be at least 2, there are no multiple zeta values of weight 1. OK, and then at weight 2, we see something more interesting. So the first multiple zeta value, if you like, is zeta 2. Here we're normalizing it by dividing by 2 pi I squared. Well, the famous formula of Euler tells you what zeta of 2 is. It's pi squared over 6. So this whole expression is minus 1 over 24. So you're free to put a minus sign on either side of that. So there's the generator at weight 2. It's the number 1 over 24. At weight 3, well, I could take a number of weight 2, and I could multiply it by 1/2. I would get a number of weight 3. So that tells me that 1 over 48 appears at weight 3. And then I see at 4, I get 1 over 5760. So here I would have a zeta 4, which by a formula similar to Euler's formula is a multiple of pi to the 4. And then there would also be a zeta 2 comma 2, but that also turns out to be expressible as a rational like this. And then there's 5, same thing, 1 over 11520. At 6, I see 1 over 2903040. And I also see this number which appeared earlier, zeta 3 squared over, I've got here 128 pi to the 6. And then for the odd generators, actually, those are going to be imaginary numbers. And for instance, you'll see the number zeta 3. So there's nothing imaginary up to weight 3. But here you'll see I zeta 3 over 8 pi cubed. Here you'll see I zeta 3 over 16 pi cubed. Here you'll see zeta 3 and zeta 5. All the odd zetas are conjecturally independent from pi, so they should all appear. Anyway, so you can go on in this way. zeta 2 comma 1 is, I guess, not allowed because it ends with a
one.
But 1, 2 would be allowed. And well, that's going to end up being expressible. It's a multiple of zeta 3. So as I said, there are many algebraic relations between these numbers. And one of the amazing things about this Zagier conjecture is that it kind of tells you how independent they all are. By the way, zeta 3 itself is known to be irrational. That's a theorem of Apéry. And it's conjectured that zeta 3, zeta 5, zeta 7, all of those are algebraically independent from each other and from pi. But that's still a conjecture. So even though this guy we know is irrational and we know pi is irrational, we don't know anything about the quotient. Okay, so let me now state the theorem which concerns these numbers appearing in the quantization formula. So this is the main result of our paper. But the tools that we're using were very much inspired by the work of Francis Brown in his 2006 thesis on the period of the moduli space of curves, and also Goncharov's work on multiple poly logarithms. And what it says is the following. So let's suppose now that we have a differential form, which is in this algebra I defined earlier. So I have CNM. Remember, that's the moduli space of marked disks. And this subalgebra of the forms, which was generated by log differentials of cross ratios. So let's take a top degree form in there. And let's suppose it's such that the integral of this form converges absolutely. Then the conclusion is that this number I, well, it lies in weight n plus m minus 2 if m is positive. So remember, m is the number of boundary marked points and n is the number of interior marked points. So if I have at least one boundary marked point, then this is the weight. And if there are no boundary marked points, then what I get is weight n minus 1. OK, so now this explains why that number, zeta 3 squared over pi to the 6, was the first one to appear. Because I told you that in Kontsevich's formula, it was manifestly transparent that these numbers had to be real. And I've given you a bound on the weights. So the first thing to appear is at h bar to the 6, where I see this weight 6 number. So if you're careful about all the normalizations, then it actually lies in 1 over 4 to the n times z tilde n, but only the real part. And as I said, there are other so-called propagators, other ways of defining the Feynman rules in this theory, which will give different numbers. But all the known explicit ones will always give rise to numbers of this type. But you could see the complex numbers I zeta 3 over pi cubed, for instance. Actually, we conjecture that this result is sharp in the sense that for a different propagator, the coefficients of the star product will generate this whole collection of numbers. And that we've checked on the computer up to weight 10 or so. So I'm going to say some words now about the proof, but before I go on, are there any questions about, yeah?
Is there a version that applies to the sphere?
Pardon me?
Is there a version that applies to the sphere?
Instead of the disk, yeah. So that was Brown's work, which was conjectured by Dillon and Goncharov that the periods of the moduli space of genus zero curves were expressible in terms of multiple zeta values.
So in that case,
yes. Yeah. So if I'm being more precise, he looked at the real locus in the moduli space of curves. So these would be, you know, collections of point. It would be like all the marked points were on the boundary. So that's this integration over the associahedron, if you like. But there are also volume integrals which you can construct over the moduli space, and those also give these numbers, which are the same flavor. Any other questions? OK, so let me give some idea of the proof. So first of all, I just need to give an alternate definition of multiple zeta values, which will be more useful for our purposes. So the first alternate definition is that zeta tilde of n1 up to nd is equal to the value at 1 of some function, which I'm going to call ln1 up to nd. And this function is defined, say, by its power series expansion, which is the same type of sum. I have a k1 to the n1, so on kd to the nd. And the only difference is that it's a power series in z, and the exponent is kd. So if I stick in z equals 1, it's transparent that I get a multiple zeta value. This is a so-called multiple polylog function. OK, so that's the first redefinition in this story, standard. And then it's also useful to re-encode. Instead of using these numbers n1 up to nd, which is a sequence of numbers, I can encode it in a binary string. So s1, the length is equal to the weight. And it's a string of the following form, 0, comma, 0 many times, and then a 1, and the total number of symbols here is n1. Yeah. So then I have a bunch more zeros, and then a 1 appears. So I would have an n2 there. And then this continues until I have a 1 and then a 0, bunch of zeros and a 1. And that's my nd. Okay. So this is just some way to go back and forth between sequences of numbers and binary strings. OK, so let me start indexing things by these binary strings, s1 up to sn. The reason that's a nice thing to do is that there's a differential equation. If I take the derivative of the polylog corresponding to some string, then what I get is a polylog where I've knocked the first symbol off the string, s2 up to sn. And then I have the log derivative of dz. And there's a or 2 pi I and z minus s1. Yeah, so dz over z if this first symbol is a 0, and dz over z minus 1 if this first symbol is a 1. So this is the so-called Kishinev-Zamolodnikov equation. And you see what it lets you do is to write any polylog iteratively by kind of integrating these differential forms. Okay, so another way to say it is LZ1 up to ZSN is the integral from 0 to 0 to Z, 1 over 2 pi I to the power N, and then I integrate DZ ZN over ZN minus SN, integral from 0 to ZN DZN minus 1 over ZN minus 1. Sn minus 1, and so on, integral 0 to z2 dz1 over z1 minus s1. See? So I'm just using that differential equation repeatedly to find an antiderivative at each stage and write this thing as a so-called iterated integral. In the sense of Chen. So it's a kind of funny thing. You're given a sequence of differential forms, a whole bunch of one forms, and then you integrate them along a single path. But you do it in this kind of iterative fashion. OK, so zeta tilde is, from this point of view, the integral from 0 to 1 of this string, by which I really mean dz1 over z1 minus s1 up to dzn, zn minus s1. Now, it was important that the string ended with 1, so that the first symbol that you integrate would be a dz over z minus 1. When you start integrating from 0, there are no singularities to worry about. But you can extend to all strings s1 up to sn using a kind of regularization. So if the string ended with a 0, it would mean that I was integrating something which had a singularity. And so the integral would also diverge. And then there's a procedure of lopping off all of the terms which diverge logarithmically to get an honest number out of the integral. So everything I say on from now on has to be regularized, but I don't have time to go into the details of that procedure. Okay. If you can just think about them as convergent integrals for the time being. But one important thing is that the regularization procedure sort of depends on a length scale. So if I really want to make sense of this for a divergent integral, I need to decorate the endpoints of integration with a tangent vector. And for instance, that allows the possibility of taking an integral from one side to the other of a single marked point. And if I integrate over a loop, the form a half loop dz over z, what I get is by the half residue theorem, pi I, so when I divide by 2 pi I get the number 1 half. So that's where the half is coming from. There's some divergent integrals which, when you regularize them, give these extra numbers. OK, so now what you do is you want to use basic operations for integrals. So how do you, you're given an integral, how do you compute it? Well, there are a handful of tricks. You can use the fundamental theorem of calculus, aka Stokes' theorem. You find a primitive and integrate over the boundary. There's Fubini's theorem, which tells you what to do when you have a product. There's really not a whole lot more beyond that. So things like Stokes and Fubini to reduce the integral of omega over this big space to these iterated integrals. So the idea is you find an algebra of differential forms which is big enough to include all the forms you want to integrate and perform all of these operations, but small enough that the arithmetic of the coefficients remains controlled. So I'm just going to indicate a little bit how that's done, and then I think I'll be out of time. So introduce a subsheaf of functions V inside the sheaf of functions on this moduli space. And this will have a weight filtration. So it'll have some pieces, W0, V, W1, V, and so on. This is the so-called sheaf of polylogarithms. And the point of this thing is that it's going to exactly have the properties that I want. So the elements, first of all, are defined by iterated integrals. So sections, local sections of this sheaf are generated by iterated integrals on the universal curve, if you like. So what we can do is choose a string. Yeah, so when I say this a sheaf, that's already involving the statement that everything is preserved under analytic continuation. So if I go around a loop, I start with something which is locally defined. I go around a loop, I'll get another thing of the same kind, but it may be multivalued.
I just wondering that what weight filtration.
The weight filtration is preserved, yeah.
I mean, is weight filtration just a filtration which is called weight? Or
it's a filtration which is called weight.
Okay,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. The term weights has an interpretation in Hodge theory, but for today it's just called weight. Okay. So choose a string in marked points and their conjugates. Okay, so let's call that S1 up to Sn. And choose endpoints, say S0 and Sn plus 1, also from among our marked points. So what I can do then to define a function is to take an element in this moduli space, which is a disk with some marked points on the boundary in the interior. And well, then I can form the iterated integral from S0 to Sn plus 1 of this string, defined in exactly the same way as before. But you see, now I have to, say, choose a path from S0 to Sn plus 1. So this depends on also on the class of a path. So this is the reason that these functions are multi-valued. If I start at some disk, I choose a path. That defines me a germ of a function in a neighborhood of this point in the moduli space. But then I start moving around, and that path, the marked points will braid, and this path will come back to a new path in the disk. And so I'll get a different function. But the difference is always something of lower weight. Okay. And so then the key facts about this sheaf of polylogarithms. So let me just summarize them in a theorem. So for instance, the first fact is a kind of analog of this KZ equation. And this is due to Brown and Goncharov, at least with Q coefficients. We had to check that it worked integrally, but it was not really any different. It says the following. If you take the derivative of a weight n function, then what you get is a weight n minus 1 function times a logarithmic derivative of cross ratios. So in other words, this is what you're going to need if you want to have antiderivatives for those cross ratios. And this is given by some totally explicit combinatorial formula which you can implement in a computer. That's important. The second thing you need when you do integration is to know when you can compute a primitive of a form. So you need some version of the Poincaré lemma. Again, this is Brown and Goncharov over Q. And us over z, it says that the inclusion of the constant sheaf of multiple zeta values as constant functions is a quasi-isomorphism where this u and m is the differential forms tensored with polylog. Yeah, so the way that I want you to think about this is that if you take a polylog and you multiply it by one of these logarithmic cross ratios, you generate a subalgebra of the Durham complex. That subcomplex is to the multiple zeta values as all differential forms are to the complex numbers. Okay, the next fact, which I think is new, is that these sheaves are acyclic. So if I take the sheaf cohomology of these sheaves of polylogarithms, they vanish for j bigger than 0. So that that involves a careful analysis of the monodromy of these functions. I'm looking at it now in individual one of these sheaves. Derived global sections, not the hyper-derived.
If you like. So this is a consequence of the previous statement.
It's not a consequence of the previous statement. So think about, how do you prove the Durham theorem? One way to do it is to say the Poincaré lemma tells you have a resolution of the constant sheaf. Then some partition of unity tells you that it's a resolution by soft sheaves, which are acyclic.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So the next statement was exactly that. This is just a consequence of the previous two, that if you take the cohomology of the global sections, so globally defined polylog forms, then the cohomology of that complex of global sections is the cohomology with coefficients in the ring Z tilde. And that's important because the topology of this space is understood. It's a k pi 1. In particular, the cohomology vanishes beyond some degree, so every volume form has a primitive inside this refined algebra. That's the key thing which lets you do all these calculations. And maybe finally, I'll just give the analog of Fubini. Which says, if you have a form on some moduli space C and M, and you have a projection which forgets some marked points, and if the integral of omega over the fibers converges absolutely, then, well, this integral over the fibers, this is a kind of relative version of the absolute theorem that I stated earlier, is going to be a polylogarithm on this smaller space. And the weight has dropped by Let's say that this is, this should have been a volume form of weight n. Then the weight has dropped by the number of interior marked points that you forgot. Okay. So now you apply this to the case where the projection is a single point, you get my theorem from earlier. But the point is that now you can prove this one point at a time. So instead of trying to prove the thing globally, you break it into smaller pieces, you just forget one point. Then the fiber is some kind of punctured disk. And there you can use some fancy version of the residue theorem to compute this integral, use Stokes, and control the weight, and so on. So I'm out of time, but I'm happy to take questions. Thanks for your attention.
Let's thank him again.
Thanks.